This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Just ahead, we talk to local advocates and medical professionals about the opioid epidemic in eastern North Carolina and what they hope to do to mitigate the impact. It's Memorial Day weekend, so you can expect an increase in motorists navigating eastern North Carolina's rural roads and highways. To make it even trickier, slow-paced texters will be out on the roads, as well as drivers going way over the speed limit, so it pays to beware during drive time at major intersections in Greenville, Jacksonville, and New Bern. Accidents here in eastern North Carolina keep climbing. According to the latest numbers from the North Carolina Division of Motor Vehicles, there were more than 251,000 crashes in the state in 2015, an 11% increase over the previous year. Patrol Sergeant with Havelock Police Department, Kimberly Tutwiler.
Every 15 minutes in the United States of America, we lose a life because someone is driving distracted or driving while impaired.
Any number of distractions can cause accidents, but DMV statistics prove that certain populations are more likely to experience collisions. Teenagers lead that list, with seniors not far behind.
It's kind of a maturity thing. Adults have more life experience, and they have been around longer than our young drivers.
The Havelock Police Department led a program at Havelock High School on Thursday, challenging students to think about the decisions they make behind the wheel.
Everybody has their phone, GPSs, whatever music they have playing. It is a huge, huge safety factor right now.
Officer Tutwiler described the every 15-minute program, which graphically displayed a major crash scene.
After the wreck, Munden's Funeral Home even brought in a hearse, and we unloaded a casket off the hearse. And we had a little mock memorial for this innocent student that was killed. I was looking around the crowd, and I think we got our point across.
Knowing when to intervene is important when dealing with a teenager. Confiscating the keys is always an option with parents. But what if it's a parent who's the unsafe driver? Many times it falls on adult children to initiate that tough conversation. Managing Director of Home Instead Senior Care, J.D. Bobbitt, says the role reversal can be difficult for some seniors to accept.
People are living longer now than they did, and so we're more likely to experience this than when people were dying younger. But your parent took care of you, they raised you, they advised you, they brought you up, and most of the time they're not very accepting of that role reversal. So you have to approach that very carefully.
Before immediately having that conversation, there are several ways to pinpoint driving difficulties. Mysterious dents, trouble turning to see when backing up, and difficulty parking are all indicators.
It's smaller things. I call it road rash. Usually it's, a fender, a bumper. It's not real big, and they don't even know that it happened. It might be the mailbox is knocked over. There's more than one new garage door in this town for people who drove through a door that was either not all the way open, or it was coming down or going up. So those are lapses in judgment and thinking that you can see pretty clearly.
Delayed reaction and response, riding the brake, driving at the wrong speed, and difficulty staying in the lane are all clear signs that it's time for the talk. Not about the birds and the bees, but about giving up the keys. JD says if you notice a family member or friend driving erratically, it's a great time to bring it up before a major accident occurs.
If they have some little scare, that might make it a little easier if you can point out, hey, Mom, we've noticed that you're not exactly in the parking space. Are you having any trouble? If they admit to it, you can carry on down that path.
This was the case for JD's mother, Harriet Bobbitt.
I remember riding with her, and to be honest, she scared the daylights out of me. Pulling into a parking space at what I would consider faster than normal and knowing that you might have a quarter inch between her right front fender and the left side of that other car, it's scary.
Mrs. Bobbitt is 86 years old, and she hasn't driven in 6 years. She's among about 85% of older adults who decide to give up their keys on their own.
The thing was, I had neuropathy in my right foot, and I noticed it all of a sudden when I tried to put on brakes. I couldn't feel the accelerator. And that's sort of alarming, to say the least.
People age 66 and older are required to renew their driver's license and pass a vision test every 5 years, while everyone else must renew every 8 years. When it was time to renew her license, she never did. Mrs. Bobbitt says it was a personal decision that she doesn't regret. Even today, she doesn't have trouble getting around.
I had always thought that I would be wild if somebody took my car away from me, or because I like driving, still have it, because my caregivers drive me when I have to go somewhere like the doctor or anything like that.
Even though giving up her keys took away some freedom, she says it was a small sacrifice for the safety of herself and others.
I don't want to die, and I certainly don't want anybody else to die because of my carelessness. I did pitch a fit like I thought I would.
If you try to have a conversation with a family member, a friend, or a neighbor that's having difficulty driving and they won't listen, intervention from the Department of Motor Vehicles may be an option. Public Relations Officer Patrice Bethia.
Our medical review unit may restrict or cancel the license of any age driver based on their visual acuity, their driving history. It could be the medications they've been prescribed by their doctor. Their mental competency may come in question, and then certainly at the recommendations of their doctors.
The request for driver reexamination form can be filled out and submitted to the DMV, where the medical review unit will investigate each case.
We'll contact the driver and have them go back into the driver license office nearest their home and take another driving test, a behind-the-wheel test.
In the majority of cases, Bethia says they impose restrictions instead of revoking someone's license. For instance, someone with vision problems may be limited to driving only during the daytime.
We understand that sometimes their family members or loved ones who might not want to be the ones to take the keys from their driver or their loved one, and so the DMV is here to kind of help support that and further investigate if there is a need for any restrictions.
If it's time to have the talk with a family member about their dangerous driving, J.D. Bobbitt says do it sooner rather than later.
You don't want to have this conversation when somebody's already in the hospital.
J.D.'s mother, Harriet Bobbitt, encourages seniors to make the decision to surrender the keys for themselves.
If I had anything to say to any of the people who are in my age bracket, they really do need to think about it. And if it is time for them to give it up, they will feel better about it if they make the decision rather than have one of their children tell them that it's time.
This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Opioid addiction is prevalent throughout the United States, including eastern North Carolina, so much so that federal and state budgets are poised to include funding to address it specifically. Governor Roy Cooper has declared an opioid crisis in North Carolina and said it's one of the biggest challenges the state faces. The majority of counties in eastern North Carolina have noticed upticks in opioid-related deaths over the past decade, including Carteret County. Chris Thomas has more.
There were 15 opiate-related deaths in 2015. The highest total since 1999. 3 years earlier, in 2012, the death toll was at 3, the lowest it had been in 15 years. Rich Jadwick, executive director of the Family Medicine and Rehabilitation Center based in Moorhead City, has about 200 clients dealing with a wide range of addictions.
A lot of opiate narcotic pain reliever use, a lot of heroin use, and also what's called comorbid use, were multiple substances.
But one kind of substance in particular is dominating his client list, opiates.
80 to 85%, the overwhelming majority.
Between 2005 and 2015, there's been a 73% increase in opiate-related deaths across the state. More than 80 of North Carolina's 100 counties have seen upticks in these death rates, especially in the southeastern end of the state, including Brunswick, New Hanover, and Pender counties. Dr. Maksud Ahmed said they're sought after for their ability to alleviate pain.
If they have pain as moderate to severe and they have not been able to get any kind of relief with non-narcotic pain medications, and they're also used for people who have been going through the end-of-life cycle because of the cancer and they have pain issues.
Ahmed founded Family Medicine and Rehabilitation Center in 1998 and is an East Carolina University graduate. He said as a patient uses an opiate more, they develop a tolerance, which can lead to higher dosages and lead some to codependency.
There are patients who are prone to addiction because of the genetic composition their brains has. So they are very high-risk medications. They need to be controlled by specially trained physician in pain management, and the patient need to be properly assessed and properly monitored if they are going to be using narcotics.
A recent study by Castlelight Health, a San Francisco-based publicly traded healthcare information company, discovered Wilmington, Jacksonville, and Fayetteville had some of the highest rates of substance abuse in the nation. Mariana Newman of Morehead City said its reach in Carteret County is the same as it is across the region, widespread and irrespective of social boundaries.
It's affecting all kinds of families, all demographics, you know, white, middle class, upper class, as well as, you know, certainly older people and younger people.
Newman was a social worker for Easter Seals of Virginia and North Carolina before retiring in 2011. Though she'd often work with individuals dealing with addiction, she said the opioid epidemic wasn't on her radar until later.
I really don't think that we understood or recognized at the time how serious and what the how much it would grow over the, you know, 5 years that I've been retired.
It's one of the reasons why she and a group of local residents started Citizens Coalition Carteret soon after the November election. She believes there's a knowledge deficit on local programs designed to improve quality of living for the county's most vulnerable residents, including those in the county's fishing communities. On June 1st, the coalition will lead a forum addressing the opiate crisis' impact on Carteret County.
The panel will be chaired by our Sheriff Asa Buck, our District Attorney Scott Thomas, one of our county commissioners, Jimmy Farrington.
The panel will also include local health and wellness professionals, including Chadwick and Dr. Moxud. It's her hope that local residents will have a better view of the epidemic and the way it's impacting the county while getting elected officials, business owners, and the population at large on the same page.
We hope to identify the gaps in service. At this point, for a lot of services, people have to travel to either Pitt County or Onslow County for treatment. And we really want to advocate for a treatment facility closer to home here in Carteret County.
But at least one healthcare professional, Rich Chadwick, is concerned what kind of impact the forum will have. He says he's been to similar events where there was little to no follow-up action.
There are a lot of meetings. There are a lot of meetings about meetings and what the task force did last week. And I think that the citizenry is a little tired of that. Forums are very good. The people on it that I understand to be on it are very good. I think we're all, you know, excellent at what we do. But if we don't align and actually walk away with something practical on the ground, it'll just be another project, just another forum.
Factors contributing to the opiate addiction epidemic are nuanced and copious. Chadwick says misconceptions about addiction to pain medication, including its root sources, are also bountiful and must be addressed to help take the stigma surrounding it away.
Take the supply off the streets and that's going to cure it. I do believe that that is a myth, that being a little bit narrow of a focus. And if we were to align all, let's say, legislative action and or resources, capital structures up against that, I think that that would miss the mark. Not that we have all missed the mark anyway, but that certainly, if that was the singular channel by which we tried to improve upon this epidemic, I think it's going to miss.
Regardless of the forum's outcome, both Chadwick and Newman agree that it may take a Herculean effort to roll back addiction's tide. In 2016, there were 278 emergency calls related to opiate overdose-related causes in Carteret County, more than there were between 2004 and 2014 combined. I'm Chris Thomas.
This is the Downeast Journal. The third annual New Bern Top Shelf Fishing Festival takes place next Friday. 50 wounded warriors and disabled veterans will participate in a day of fishing and fellowship. Today, Mac McKee speaks with founder and chairman of Operation North State, Terry Snyder, about the event next week.
You founded Operation North State back in 2010, and the organization offers a variety of military support services. Now, that includes the Top Shelf Fishing Festivals. Can you tell me about the events and how long you've been doing it, Terry?
Yeah, this all came about in the last month of 2010. And I had a North Carolina product store. It's all about promoting North Carolina's people, places, products, and pride. And I took that store and took the idea from it, seeing moms and dads, aunts and uncles coming into the store wanting to send items to their deployed troops. So we started off in 2010 sending 500 care packages to North Carolina's deployed troops. And when the box showed up, everything in it from the messages down to the snack items were all North Carolina related. So that's where the idea first started.
There have been fishing festivals so far in Edenton, Lake Norman, and Baden Lake. And coming up, the next one is in New Bern next Friday. Now, what kind of turnout are you already expecting for this?
It's not so much the public that we're wanting to come out in groves. We'd certainly like to see some of the public to come out at the time of the weigh-in and see the smiles and the camaraderie, because that's why we have these things. There's just not a lot of happiness in some of these wounded warriors and disabled veterans' lives because of all the PTSD and traumatic brain injury and some other issues they have. But as far as the turnout, we are looking to have 50 host boaters on the water, and each boater will be taking out a wounded warrior or disabled veteran and spending the day fishing with them from 8 in the morning until 3. And then they'll come back in at 3, they'll weigh their fish, and then we'll stay there at Lawson Creek, and we'll go to the picnic area, and we'll have some awards, and we'll have a dinner before we leave, and the day will wrap up right around 5 o'clock. And this is our third year, so it's well received. The community comes out and helps us in a big way, but that's pretty much how we spend the day.
In addition to enjoying a day out on the water, what do you hope that the participants overall will take away from the experience themselves?
Well, we hold 8 of these festivals throughout the year. Those festivals collectively create around 675 outings or opportunities. The Wounded Warriors Disabled Veterans, they build a bond with these host boaters, and they do a lot of one-on-one fishing that we as Operation North State, we don't even get involved in. So what we're hoping will happen, they will build these friendships and the fellowship, and coming from those fellowships will be those one-on-ones. And anything we can do to get these wounded warriors and disabled veterans out of their homes, back into their community, a lot of them have to get in touch with their life again, themselves. They have to get in touch with their family, their community, the general public. Some don't relate real well with the general public. So anytime you can have an event like this that puts a smile on their face, a comfort level, and gets them out, you're doing the right thing. So that's what we truly hope we can accomplish, and we've been able to do so far with the festivals.
In addition from speaking with the folks at these festivals and who attend them, do you think the veterans benefit more from the activity of fishing or being around other veterans, or both?
Oh, it's both. It's both. It's both. I hear, as soon as an event is over, I hear from the Wounded Warriors Disabled Veterans how much this means to them, the opportunity to meet someone else from a different part of the state. And then from there, again, they start sharing friendships. They start getting to know each other's families. And then the host boaters. The host boaters will tell me, Terry, you know, I'm fishing for prizes, fishing for points, fishing for dollars in my tournaments and on weekends, and some fish professionally. And just said, you know, this experience having one of these wounded warriors and disabled veterans on my boat, I don't have anything like this in my trophy case. And when guys start telling you what this means, how it's changed their lives, and how they want to do more of it. So, yeah, it truly is both, and that it touches a lot of lives.
Now, is there still room to participate in the festival, and how can people sign up?
The biggie is we still need some host boaters. I think we're at 34 host boaters of our 50, so we've still got about 15 or 16 host boaters. We could really use some help bringing in those host boaters, and hopefully some guys will, you know, and gals will come out and show their expertise, provide their equipment, and that's kind of how people can help right now.
Is there anything else that the wounded warriors and disabled veterans need to bring themselves?
This day, all they need to do is show up. Some of them have fished with us long enough now to where they've accumulated some gear. But still, when the angler shows up, he will have the bait, he will have the tackle, he'll have the expertise, the boat, rods and reels. So really, the wounded warrior disabled veteran, all they have to do is show up. The North Carolina Wildlife Commission and the Coastal Marine, they have waived the fishing license for the day. And so it's just, we truly want to make this a Wounded Warrior. It's your tank of gas. You might need a hotel room because some of them come in from over 4 hours away. But if you get down here, we're going to show you a good day.
Terry, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Down East Journal. We certainly appreciate your time.
Well, it's certainly an honor, and thank you so much for helping us and, you know, do what we're doing down there. And I'm just so proud of your community and everybody just lending a hand. Thank you very much.
We are asking you today to support responsible journalism and relaxing classical music by making your membership pledge or additional gift before the end of our fiscal year, June 30th. You may have received a Public Radio East letter asking for your support. If so, send back your donation in the mail in any amount today. Your pledge makes possible all of the varied programs that you enjoy. You can help us meet our goal for the year with your membership. Listener support is so critical in maintaining this nonprofit service. We ask that you make your pledge in one of three ways: online at publicradioeast.org, by calling 1-800-222-9832, or by sending back the return envelope you may have saved from our recent letter asking for your support. Thank you.
For the holiday, it's the National Endowment for the Arts Heritage Fellows, including the Staples Singers, Del McCoury, Wanda Jackson, and the late Coco Taylor. 2016 Fellows are Irish accordionist Billy McComiskey, Mexican singer Artemio Posadas, and Mardi Gras Indian Chief Monk Boudreau. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
American Roots, Saturday evening at 6 o'clock on all of the PRE Public Radio East stations.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. This week, the Master Gardener volunteers and I piled into a couple of vehicles for one of our educational field trips. We drove to Wilmington to visit the Stanley Redder Carnivorous Plant Garden. The garden is named in honor of Stanley Redder, who spent 25 years planting and tending this site. I had never visited this site before, and boy was I in for a treat. Carnivorous plants are naturally found in poor soils that have very little nutrients that the plants need to survive and grow. While most of these plants have evolved in bogs around the world, the Venus flytrap is native only to a small area in a 60-mile radius around Wilmington. Like the Venus flytrap, this garden is truly unique. It is the only public carnivorous plant garden in the world and is free and open to the public year-round. How cool is that? We parked behind a local school and started down a wide paved trail. I kept my eyes peeled, straining to see a Venus flytrap or a pitcher plant tucked within the surrounding plants. We rounded a corner and I was excited to see an observation platform on the side of the trail. I knew that we'd see some plants there, but I was not at all prepared for what I saw. What opened up in front of me was a depression filled with thousands of plants. Green and red pitcher plants, Venus flytraps, and native orchids. The green, yellow, bronze, and variegated hoods of pitcher plants stood up tall, swaying gently in the breeze. Below that nodded the white flowers of the Venus flytraps and the flowers of the common grass pink, a native orchid. Even more amazing, there was a footpath that led down and amongst the plants. We were off the platform in an instant, walking through the planting, careful to stay on the trail and make sure that we didn't crush a small plant underfoot. Each plant has its own form of adaptation. The low-growing Venus flytraps were easy to find once we noticed their white flowers. The pitcher plants were definitely the divas of the garden. The yellow pitcher plants are among the showiest, with large yellow flowers in the spring and pitchers that can reach 3 feet in height. The diminutive sundews were the hardest to find. The narrow leaves of the sundew are covered with tentacles that are tipped in droplets of sticky liquid. To a visiting insect, this looks and smells like nectar, but instead, it's a sticky trap. Whether you're looking at these plants up close and marveling at the intricate details of each, or if you step back and let yourself be entranced by the huge swath of thousands of pitchers and flowers nodding in the breeze, this garden is not to be missed. So with summer vacation fast approaching, I would encourage you to add the Stanley Rutter Carnivorous Plant Garden to your list of day trips.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal. Have a great Memorial Day weekend.